Gentlemen, welcome to minute 86 of season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic thriller, Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Alex Marcus, the podcast director of PopBreak.com. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about this movie with you. So why don't we start with the basics? Why don't you tell people what's your history with this movie, if at all? Do you have a history with this movie?
Yeah, so...
Or is your history of this movie because I said, come on my podcast?
Basically, it was that, yeah. My history of this movie is knowing that it existed, knowing that it was remade about 15 years ago, starring Denzel Washington as a Tony Scott movie. I didn't see that either, to be honest, but I did remember that that happened.
You lucked out.
I always knew that this was like a classic film. It was one that I wanted to get round to eventually, especially with the cast and the director, but I never had a reason to. And so I was so excited when you asked me to come on because it finally gave me an excuse to watch it.
That's right. That's the whole thing with movies. You just need an excuse to watch them. I mean, me personally, I don't need an excuse. The excuse for me is, okay, I feel like watching this movie or checking it out. But with most people who are not like me, who don't watch 100 movies a month, they have to bide their time to find time to watch movies. So I'm glad I was able to give you a reason to rewatch or to watch this movie for the first time. There's another remake also. There was a TV remake from 1998 with Edward James Olmos.
I saw that on IMDb, and I was very intrigued. I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, you can find that one actually on YouTube. It's interesting. Again, it's neither of the remakes are anywhere close to being as good as this movie. I mean, I'm a big fan of not making remakes because I think it's just not worth it. You know, it's the rare case where there's a movie which you can make it so much better by making a remake. Again, maybe you know of some that you would point out. I mean, I know of remakes that come close to being as good as the original, but it's very rare to get something that's better.
I like a movie that is, like, if you're talking about, like, a classic story, sort of like a Hamlet or an Othello or something like that, I like to see different people's takes on those movies or those stories. And that is a remake in a sense. But the kind of just taking a story and just doing a straight remake from, like, one movie that came out 20 years ago and be like, well, it's old now, we got to refresh it. I think it very rarely feels interesting enough. But I always, whenever they do come out, I usually will give them a chance because I'm always like, well, maybe this creator has an interesting perspective on this story, can bring something else out into it that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But almost always that ends up not being the case. You're just that's like, true. Oh yeah, I like the real one better.
Yeah. It's basically the way that that these things work. There are a few that maybe, I mean, obviously we're going to have the game every day where you're going to have to try and guess name that remake. So maybe we'll come across some of them that are slightly better. I mean, I don't have, like, Shakespeare movies on here on the list. So, for instance, Hamlet, I'm a huge fan of Kenneth Branagh's 96 Hamlet. And I think it's, much better than the Mel Gibson version from 90, which was also very good, and the Laurence Olivier version from 48, which, again, is also good. But it's weird. I don't think of those movies as remakes. I just think of them, as you said, a revisioning of the original story type of thing.
But like, yeah, it's an adaptation, right?
Exactly. But when you take a movie like Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, and they're not making an adaptation of it. They're making a remake of it. They're saying, okay, let's modernize it. Let's change this. Let's change that. And it's just doesn't work as well, in my opinion. You know, I could be wrong.
I feel there's a movie that might be coming up a little bit later on one of my top five lists that had a remake this past year that I have a lot of interesting thoughts on. And I don't want to say more because I don't want to ruin the list. But in that example, it was a situation where it was a movie that was kind of unseen at the time. It was well respected, but not a lot of people had watched it. And so getting a chance to have it be remade meant that people got to get familiarized with the story more. So it's not like taking this classic and saying, I could do another version of it. It's more of like taking this like unsung sort of like diamond in the rough and trying to like bring it with like big stars and a big marketing campaign and say like, can we actually make that into something that people will want to see now? And I thought that That is exactly how I would like to see movie remakes happen in the
And do you think,
future.
I mean, without having te without telling you what it is, do you think they did a better job of it
I
with the new
think
version
the
of it? It happens.
I
I'm not saying it's impossible, but
yeah, the interesting thing about it is that I think that I liked all of the changes that they made to the story in order to modernize it and make it feel like it makes more sense in this place, and like the choices that they made to add to fill in some of the pieces that were maybe missing, but ultimately I do still think that the original is actually the better film. So,
okay, like if you were to recommend to somebody to watch it, you would say watch the original.
correct.
Exactly. See that I think that's basically the bottom line. You know, when I look at a movie and if I'm going to recommend it to somebody, do I recommend the remake or do I recommend the original? Or both. I mean, I might, but actually it's never they're never going to be completely equal. I mean, like even and I've talked about this many times, 12 Angry Men. So you have 12 Angry Men from 1957. In 1997, it was remade with Jack Lemmon. Amazing the way that they did it, you know. But I still think it's on the same level as the original. You know, it has a great cast. You know, the dialogue is almost exactly the same. There's a few things that they modernize and change things and stuff like that. But if someone were to say to me, "Okay, want to go watch 12 Angry Men," I'm still going to recommend to them to watch the original with Henry Fonda. I'm not going to say go watch
Right.
the. I'm not going to say go watch the one from 97. I'm going to say, watch the one from 57. And if you really like it and you want to watch another one, watch 97.
Yeah, because in that situation, it's like, congrats, you guys did it. You made something that's as good as the original, but the original still exists, so why wouldn't you just watch that?
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, one of my guests told me that he actually worked on that movie, on the 97
Oh,
version. You know, when
cool.
he was, I think he was in charge of like marketing or something like that for the movie. And he was telling me stories, you know, that he was sitting and talking with Jack Lemmon and with, you know, with some of the other actors that were there and stuff like that. Very, very cool.
Nice. I'm
Yes.
partial to the 12 Angry Men, from Inside Amy Schumer from a few years back. It was a very good sketch.
Okay,
She
but
did like a
you
Amy
think it's
Schumer has like
better?
a
You think it's better than
well
57? I've never seen it. I now you've now given me something to go check out.
You should check it out. What I think is that if you're going to do something like that, right? If you're gonna instead of doing a straight remake, like try to take that story and do something new with it, like completely new. That's kind of like subverses or satirical or moving, evolving the story somewhere. Like that's, I think that is much more respectable as a creative pursuit than just trying your best to recreate the thing that already exists.
Okay, makes sense. Okay, all right. So, Minute 86 begins with Mrs. Jenkins giving an update and ends with the old man trying to explain things. So, you know, we've been going through this movie now for the last few months. We've gotten to know a lot of the characters. We've reached a point where you know the hijackers have left the train, but nobody knows that they've left the train, or nobody outside of the train itself know that they've left the train. And you know they're following the train as it's rolling down the tracks because you know they needed to get only green lights along the way. So I always love one of the things I love about this movie, and I've mentioned this many times, is the technology that we see on the screen. You know, from 51 years ago, where you know they just have all these like blinking lights. You know, it's a little more advanced than what they had on like the Star Trek TV show, but it's still funny that it looks very similar to that, just blinking lights. You know.
So much more cinematic than just like the touch screens that probably exist now at subway terminals.
Yeah. Exactly. And then so we hear Mrs. Jenkins say on the radio. She goes, Pelham 123 is between Astor Place and Bleecker. Speed's increasing. And then we see Rico on the other end, you know, picking up the information. And you know, he then passes it on over to Garber, which again, it's just really funny that they don't have a direct line. It makes sense, but you know, nowadays it would be like, okay, I'm just gonna send you a text message or whatever and tell you where they are. Or you know, a direct line, but here you have to go through different points in order to be able to get to you know to Garber to give him this information. Then we hear Rico's voice, and he goes, "Pelham 123 now reported between Astor Place and Bleecker. picking up speed. So again, it's funny because he's saying exactly what she's saying. And then we see a
But
shot.
he's Jerry Stiller, and it's
Yeah, of
so much
course.
more entertaining.
Oh, he's great in this movie. This is probably the earliest movie I've seen with him in it, and he's just great.
This is the only time I've ever seen him acting in a way where he's not like comedy star Jerry Stiller. You know, like I'm used to him being on like Seinfeld and like King of Queens and like all that stuff. Like I've never seen him in this like dramatic role before. And obviously, like he's playing a lot of comedy within the drama, but doing an excellent job. And it just like, it really was wild for me to see him like that because I've never seen him in that mode before.
I mean, again, he and Matho have great rapport here when they're making little jokes, as this. I mean, this is like a very deep thriller, and the way that both Matho and Stiller deal with things is makes it lightens the mood on everything, and it's just
Well,
done
what
really
I
well.
love about it is I really feel like, and this goes across the board with the casting of this film, which is really tremendous. Everyone in this movie feels like actual New Yorkers that you're catching in the middle of a like one random day,
Yes.
right? And there's such an authenticity to it that just really makes it feel a lot more interesting and engaging than otherwise. Like the
Yes.
fact that these are just a bunch of like middle-aged men who are tired, and they're just like, we're just trying to get through their shift, and now they got to deal with this nonsense. And like, they're taking it seriously, but they're also just like, ugh, come on. Like, are we seriously having to do this right now? Like, there's just like a real authenticity to it that I just really appreciated.
Right, and it also has to go with the fact that at this time, there were a lot of plane hijackings and things like that, but no one had ever tried to hijack a train before. So
Right, because
the whole
you're trapped.
concept.
Why would you do like that's what I love about it at the beginning of the movie. They were just like, wait, why? Why are they doing this? This is just crazy. We could surround you from all sides, including a top. Like, what? This is the worst idea ever. Why are you doing it? But kids, that's like a great way to start out because it shows how at every step of the way they're underestimating the criminals, which makes it so much more fun.
Well, again, that's why if you've seen this so many times, then it's not as surprising, but it's still fun to watch everything that's going on. I mean, I've seen this movie dozens of times, so that for me. But you seeing it for the first time, you're the whole time you're saying, okay, how do you what you're asking the same questions that the characters are asking. Why are they doing this? What are they going to get out of this? And then you say to yourself, in the end, you say, okay, now it makes sense. Now I understand why they do this. So it's just very, very cool to watch the whole thing as it moves along and stuff like
I do have to say, the second that I saw them with their mustaches, I was like, at some point, all those mustaches are coming off.
that.
So I felt proud of myself for calling that right away.
Okay, I can't claim to know that because the first time I saw this was over 40 years ago.
Sure. Well,
So
we
I.
could just say that you spotted it too. We can give you
No,
credit for that.
because I got to tell you, the mustaches don't look fake. They do it in a way that they look real.
They're convincing mustaches, but I
Yes.
think the tell for me was that they all have mustaches, and it just felt like, if they all have mustaches, it must be a disguise.
Well, did you notice also the jackets and the hats and all that stuff? Okay, right.
Well,
Again.
and that's part of the fun excitement of the start of the film is like you're seeing these people, and obviously, like the camera is paying close attention to them, and they're acting kind of shifty in different sort of idiosyncratic ways. But they're also showing you lots of other people on the train, and at first, it's not really clear what exactly is going on, why these particular people are important, why other people who you're seeing are maybe not important, and then you start to notice, like, oh, all of these specific people are dressed the same. They've got the mustaches and the glasses and the hat and you're like, oh, they're all in on something together. This is like a coordinated thing happening. And there's like an excitement to like that growing understanding of what's happening as it plays out in real time.
Exactly. And then we get a shot of Garber in the police car, in the back seat of Daniel's police car as they're flying down the street to try and catch the train at some point. And I happen to notice on the on the side there, first of all, there's a pizza shop. It says L'Elite Pizza Shop. That's like on the corner there. So I tried looking it up and I couldn't find anything on that, because again, it's been 50 years, so the assumption is that pizza place is no longer around.
Yes,
Even though
unfortunately,
it would have been really cool
dear.
to find it.
It would have been. And listen, I mean, every once in a while, so I've lived in Manhattan. I don't live there currently, but I lived there for 4 years, in my 20s. And some places have been around for 100 years when you walk down the streets, and then other things are gone within a few months. So you really never know. That pizza place, it had its chance to stand the test of time.
Exactly. And then a little bit down the street from that, there's a big sign that says Jefferson Screws Nuts and Bolts. It says the Jefferson Screw and Bolt Industry, the Jefferson Screw Corporation. That's what it was called. So that one I also looked up, and that I actually found,
Wow.
which I was impressed that was able. See, no wonders of the internet, the things you can try and find. I didn't find that much, but I found some stuff. I found that it was a corporation or a business that was opened on January 3rd, 1955, and it was known as the Jefferson Screw Corporation from 1955 until 1977. So obviously 3 years after this movie came out, and then they changed the name to the Jefferson Screw and Bolt Industries Inc. And then they went out of business in on March 30th, 1983.
Oh, my birthday.
There you go.
Several years before I was born, but my birthday.
Well, yeah, so you caused it. There you go. You
Yeah.
are responsible. Alex is
Exactly.
responsible for the Jefferson Screw Company closing down.
They knew that I was coming about 7 years later on that day. They had to clear out.
Yeah, if they knew, then when you know, you know. There's nothing you can do about that. But again, that's one of the things I love about watching a movie from 50 years ago and trying to see what's still around and what's not. When you get a chance. I mean, sometimes they're just flying by and you don't really see it. But the Jefferson sign is nice and large. So,
Yeah. Well,
it
and
would
that's
look.
what's so great about New York City is that, if you just walk down the streets of New York, you see, every era of New York still is present somewhere in the city. And it's all just, stacked on top of each other. So you'll see a building or a restaurant or a storefront that's clearly from the 70s and one in a building that has architecture from the 1920s. And then, another one that was built 6 weeks ago, just, giant glass building. And it's, all of it is just, jammed on top of each other. And it's a really interesting. Like every walk is a walk through history if you're paying attention.
Oh well, yeah. Well, come on. We all know that even Cosmo Kramer set up a tour around New York to see old stuff about New York. So why not?
Absolutely. Yeah. He was
And
ahead of his time.
speaking of Cosmo Kramer, as they continue down the street, you see a corner coffee shop which really looks like Monk's. It's not, but it just gives the impression that it looks like Monk's because it's right on the corner. Even
Yeah.
though. We just get the external shot of it, and then we're gonna get a nice long conversation between Garber and Daniels, and then Garber says it doesn't make any sense. They know we're monitoring their position, and we ought to be following them. And then Daniels goes, so it's dumb. Who said crooks were smart? But these have been smart. They haven't made a single mistake. I tell you. We're overlooking something, Inspector. Okay. He's and they give them time to think about this. I like the detective work that they show here. That
Yeah.
Garber's sitting in the back of a taxi, or not a taxi, back of a police car, and he realizes, wait a second, something's off here. I got to figure this out.
Yeah.
And
But something that the
and I like.
dynamic of that I think is so fun is that the police officer that he's talking to is so frustrated by him because ultimately what Garber is saying now is the exact opposite of what he said 5 minutes ago when he was like, "Yeah, we got to follow them. There's no way they can get out of the train, so we have to follow them. That's the only thing." And then he occurs to him a couple of minutes later, like, "Oh, maybe they got out of the train and they found a way around it." And he's like, "That's what I said 5 minutes ago. You said that wasn't possible." And
Yeah.
he's like, "Yeah, but I think it has been." It's like. That was my idea. Now you're calling. Now you're stealing it. There's just like a fun sort of back and forth to it that I liked.
And again, I think part of it also has to do with the fact that, when Garber first met Daniels, there's a little bit of tension between them, and I think that tension still remains. About him not realizing that he's black. It's like.
Yeah, Julius Harris is the actor who I'm sure you've spoken about already at this point, but he's
Briefly,
really he gets very little to do in this movie, but I think he makes the most of all of his scenes. And that's a really stock character that could just be very forgettable, and I think he really maximizes his screen time.
Because again, his dialogue is so so. You don't really have much else to say there. And then the scene continues, and we're back inside of the train tunnel itself, and we actually see the hippie on the ground, which I think is also great, because you have these four guys that are in the process of getting rid of their disguises, and they don't know what's going on, but we can see that there's somebody watching them, injured but watching them, from afar. And then Mr. Blue goes, "Okay, new hats." And then everyone pulls out a hat from the, from their jackets. Which, again, this is very cleverly set up. And everyone who's seen this movie knows that Tarantino borrowed so much from this for some of his later movies, or some of his
Oh,
movies
sure.
that came out afterwards, especially Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the dress and the disguises and the names and all that stuff. So it's just perfectly done here. So
Yeah, it's amazing that if you can steal so wantingly and then just be like, it's an homage, and then he's like, oh, that's incredible, very smart. I say
no,
that
but
as a big
also,
fan of Quentin Tarantino, but it's
but think about it, where he's quote unquote stealing the information from. He's stealing it from a movie that most people don't know.
sure.
He's not stealing it from something that everyone is familiar with, and then you say, "Oh, okay, for sure, that's he's copying that movie." It's the type of
Yeah.
thing that you have to really know movies like Tarantino does, in order to know where to take bits and pieces of the story to build your own story in a different way. And again, he doesn't take the whole story; he takes little elements. And I think that's part of Tarantino's genius, is that because he's so well versed in movies, he's able to take elements from various movies and put them together. And on the one hand, as you said, say this is an homage, but on the other hand, create something that's even better than all of the other sum parts on its own.
Right. Yeah, and also it adds like these specific details that are so other people would notice and think, well, it's so minor. Like, that's not the important part. The important part is like, oh, it's like Robert Shaw, and he's like a very sophisticated British man. And that's what is interesting about it. And what somebody like Quentin Tarantino knows is that, like, no, these little tiny details, these specificities that are here, that they're Mr. Blue and Mr. Green and stuff. Like, that actually brings in the audience in a way that they might not, when they leave the theater, be able to verbalize. But in the moment, it really sucks you in, because then you develop these, you don't know who these people are. You don't have, like, his name is Brian, his name is Sam, but you get these identities that are kind of like mysterious, but also accessible in an easy way to understand and to remember and to latch onto. And it just makes all of those scenes so much more impactful. And I think someone like Quentin Tarantino sees that and is like, yes, I need that for my movie as well.
Correct. And again, it when he does that, and then everyone says, "Oh, it's an homage." Reservoir Dogs has homaging to Taking Apollo 123. It's people who like Reservoir Dogs say, "Oh, maybe I should go check out Apollo 123."
Right.
That's the thing I love about it, because it gives you an idea of where to go look for something else.
Yeah. Well, and that's, Quentin Tarantino, he got his start working at a video rental store, right? That's the
That's
whole
right.
deal, is that's he wants to bring you in and sell you on all of these great random movies that he loves that he knows you haven't heard of.
That's right. And then now most people have heard of them because of it,
Yes.
which again is amazing, because you didn't have that in earlier movies. You don't have movies in the 70s that are, giving homages to movies from the 40s, and you go, oh wow, I'm not going to go check out that movie from the 40s. But in the
Yeah,
90s,
well, I think that to be fair, I think that directors were definitely doing that back then, but it was a lot harder for just an average person to then follow through on that. Like, there, if you did read in a review or an interview, like, oh, like this reference, like this in Chinatown, like the director was referencing this like noir film from the 40s, like, then what? What do you do? There, if it's the 70s, like there aren't video rental stores to go to. You can't stream it online, right? You might get lucky and happen across a movie theater playing an old movie, but the odds of that happening are super small, especially if it's a movie that is being chosen by a filmmaker because of this like one random detail that's otherwise not very well known.
right.
So I
You're like
think
watching
once you get
Channel
into
11
the
and saying, wait, when is WPIX going to show it?
Exactly.
See,
So now, like
I know
once you
New
get
York
into the 90s,
references.
there you go. But yeah, so like once you get into the 90s, like now you have the ability at home to find these random movies that the directors are talking about in their interviews and go back and watch them. And that like builds the film culture that we're now living inside of, 30 years later, which is pretty cool.
Correct. Exactly. So, these guys are all just looking around, putting on the hats. It's funny the way how each of them, did you pay attention to what type of hats each of them is putting on?
I noticed that there's different hats. I know that our guy, that our last man standing, he gets the most notable different hat, I
You think
thought. The
Mr.
one
Green?
that makes,
Mr.
yes, the
Green.
one that makes him look the most like unbecoming, right? Like nondescript, like the easiest to blend into the background. Like I felt like that was what his hat was giving off, and I felt like that was very purposeful for where we would be following him later in the film.
Again, he puts on like a fur hat as if it's going to be freezing cold outside, and that's what he needs.
Yeah.
Mr. Gray puts on like what looks like I don't know if it's a completely a baseball hat. It looks more like a train conductor's hat, but
Sure.
it still fits him well, with
Or
that.
like one of those like old baseball caps from like the 1920s,
Right, exactly. And then Mr. Blue, he doesn't just put on his hat the way that he does. He puts it on slanted, also trying to like partially covering his eye. As they're panning through this, then they show us the shot of the hippie on the ground reaching for his gun that's on the ground. We see a bloodied hand as he's picking up the gun, and he picks it up and starts looking towards what's going on. And then the shot changes, and we're back on the train, and we see the train just barreling through the tunnel with everything that's going on. And it's a great viewpoint the way that they do it, the way that they show the whole thing.
Yeah,
And
and it's interesting because what do you call him? The hippie, right? He
well, that's his title. I mean, we know that he's a cop, but
Yeah. But so like he's a character who's incredibly his function is very important at this point in the film, but he's not like a character that we've gotten to know in any way. So
not
I
at
think that
all.
it's interesting that he basically his POV becomes just like a conduit for the audience. And so we're not getting like close-ups on his face, like trying to watch him figure out like the tension of what to do in this moment, and like formulate a plan. Instead, his whole function in that scene is to be the eyes of the audience to help build tension for the audience about like what's going to happen next from this vantage point. I think that that's very interesting.
Correct. And what's really cool about it is, again, we don't know 100% that throughout the entire movie we don't know he's the cop. So he's sitting there waiting to bide his time. He's not trying to stop them because he knows that he'll die. He can't take on all four of these guys at the same time.
Were
But
you a
once
little bit disappointed that it wasn't a lady cop, as they refer to it multiple times? Because in the
again,
lead up, when
I've
they're
seen
like,
this
there's
so
an
many
undercover
times.
cop, we don't know who it is.
And they said,
And then they,
I never thought they asked.
yeah, they keep saying, like, oh, maybe it's a she. I don't know. And then and every time that is said in the, control room, the one guy who's just like mad about everything is like, oh gosh, if it's a woman, that's even worse. No wonder why nothing good is happening. And it's like, so I thought it was kind of funny that like at the end, they didn't even pay that off with it being a woman. I thought like, oh, okay. Like, what was the point of all of that?
Well, no, they did though, because later on, because the hippie has long hair, Garber says, "We'll be with you soon, miss." Paramedics on the way. He thinks it's a woman.
Okay, so there it is. That was all a lead up for that one joke.
That's right. It's lead up for that one joke,
Okay.
which goes over everyone's head, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. So the train just barrels down the way, and we see people on the train that one of them goes, "I never knew this thing went so fast." Another one goes, "We're gonna be killed." And then the old man goes, "Stop it. Nobody's gonna get killed. How about you know, old man?" He says, "But I do know. I've been riding the subway since before you were born. I'm an expert. You see, they have something." And then that's where he's gonna get cut off. So
Yeah,
he's
I
not
have
gonna
to
get it.
say, they could have gone older for the old man. Like, I felt like that man was like 55 years old, and he was acting like he was like a 90-year-old man. It's like, have you been riding the subway since before this like 40-year-old person was born? I don't think so, sir. I don't think you have.
Well, he reminds me actually of have you ever seen the Eddie Murphy? No, sorry, it's from Coming to America, where Eddie Murphy's playing the
Sure.
old white guy. He looks very much
Yes.
like him.
Yes, that's a very good call. I wonder if that was like inspiration. That definitely is a similar vibe. But at
I
least Eddie Murphy in old age makeup looked like an old man. This man did, just did not seem that old to
Okay, well,
me.
Michael Gordon is 60 when this movie came out.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He died 12 years later at the age of 72. It's like it's not even he never, I guess he didn't reach the old man stage where you would think about that.
Right. And that's very sad. But it is like he looks like he's 60. He does not look like I feel like his dialogue is written for an 80-year-old man.
True, I agree with you on that, but you do also know that in older movies, for some reason people looked older. I don't know why.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I think
Like
it's the smoking and the drinking.
when I don't know, I don't know. When I did It's a Wonderful Life, we were like seeing people in there, and they're like, okay, this is an old man, and like he's 48. Like
Yeah. Yeah, people smoked a lot more and were around people who smoked a lot more. And between that and the alcohol, I think it really just, and we didn't understand how important it was to like drink water back then, you know, like good skincare regimen just was not on the table for folks. So I think that had a lot to do with it.
maybe. I don't know. And mid-sentence, he gets cut off by the end of this minute. So, is there anything else you want to say about this particular minute?
No, only that just like the tension is mounting in a way that's very interesting because there's so much chaos and around what's going on in the train, and that is juxtaposed with the sort of like madcap energy on the street with Matthau and the other police officers in the car. And then with our actual bad guys, there is this sort of like cold, cool, calm, methodical, like we're just executing the next stage of our plan. So it's like these three very different energies that are all bouncing against each other that really is building tension in a way that I think is more interesting than I think people might give it credit for. Because, you know, usually you think in order to build tension, you want it to just keep ratcheting up and ratcheting up and ratcheting up. But instead, what the director is doing here is kind of allowing the different tones and the different energies of these specific parts of the story to bounce off of each other, and the discordant nature of that to be what is driving the tension higher and higher, which is very cool.
It really is. It's great. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Matthau Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Matthau performances. So Alex, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, so my number five is a film that I think a lot of people may not ever have heard of, but I actually saw this as a child in the movie theaters. Now, why did I see this as a child in the movie theaters? I can't quite say because it's definitely not a children's film. But it's a film called Hanging Up. It's Diane Keaton, Meg Ryan, and Lisa Kudrow. And I believe I probably saw it because I was a Lisa Kudrow fan back then. It came out in the year 2000, so I was 10. I've seen it as an adult since. It's a Nora Ephron and her sister wrote the script, and it was directed by Diane Keaton. And Walter Matthau plays the dad, basically, in this. It's about three sisters living in LA. They all have different relationships with their father. Their father is basically on his deathbed, and it forces all of the sisters to kind of like come back together and figure out their stuff. And I'm a sucker for a movie like that. And I think as far as like a late in life Walter Matthau performance, I think it's pretty top notch because by this point in his career, he had kind of fallen into the sort of I'm just like a grumpy old man. Like literally he was in a bunch of grumpy old men movies, right?
Only two,
And I
but
don't think yeah, and I don't and a lot others that were, grumpy old man adjacent.
the
And
honorable.
I don't think those movies always like did I gave him the type of vehicle that he probably deserved as a person with a great career. And I thought that for a late in his career performance, this is really a nice showcase. He gets to be tender, he gets to be sweet. He's playing a character who was kind of a bastard at some point in time, and that's also very well like believable for Walter Matthau. So I love it, and I think it's like a very underappreciated, underwatched movie that people should check out. So that's my number five.
Cool. Okay.
My number four is a film called Cactus Flower, which I'd never seen until I was prepping for this podcast. And I asked some people, I was like, okay, what are some Walter Matthau movies that I should watch? And that was one of them that they told me. And I'm so glad that I did. It's one of the first films that Goldie Hawn was in. Ingrid
And she
Bergman and
won an
Walter.
Oscar for it.
She did, which is great. And Ingrid Bergman and Walter Matthau are the other like main actors in this. And it's the sort of the movie that I love. I mean, as an old school Frasier fan, I love a French farce. I love a like everybody is thinking somebody is someone else, and there's just like one lie that is needlessly complicated at the center of it, and it kind of just spools out from that. And that's totally what this movie is. It's basically Walter Matthau plays this man. He's like a dentist. He's a high society sort of guy who's been a playboy bachelor his whole life. He's got the Ingrid Bergman plays his nurse at the dental office, who is basically his work wife, but there's no sexual chemistry between them. There's no tension. There's no nothing. It's very like businesslike, right? And we find out very quickly, like, he's been dating Goldie Hawn, who's his 21-year-old, who is like, so free and over dramatic, but like very sincere and very sweet. And when he first started dating her, he told her that he was married with children as a way to make sure that she didn't ever want to marry him, which is wild. And then he decides he actually does want to marry her, and so he has to tell her that he's breaking up with his wife so he can marry her. And because Goldie Hawn is so sweet, she's saying she wants to meet his wife. She wants to make sure that his wife is okay. And so then he has to get his nurse, played by Ingrid Bergman, to kind of play his wife in a series of increasingly silly and heartfelt miscommunications. And it's very fun rom-com. I don't totally love the ending, I'll say that, but I won't spoil it if you haven't seen it. But I think it's a great showcase for all the actors and really good showcase for Walter Matthau, like showing you what he can do as a sort of like little bit of like a pompous blowhard kind of guy, who lacks self-awareness while also seeming like he feels like he knows everything that's going on. Like he's a master of his domain, even though he's a bit oblivious to everything. Have you seen that one?
I've seen, of course, I've seen it.
Okay.
The thing I love about Walter Matthau is you don't think of him as a womanizer or whatever it is, but he plays that character so well.
Yeah.
He's not the type of he's not the heartthrob, but he's been in
No.
so many movies where he is the man that all the women are running after, for
Right.
whatever reason.
And I think like he does, he's not a 20-year-old in that mode, right? He's a middle-aged man at this point. And I feel like he does a good job of channeling that certain kind of like middle-aged man who is he's looks good on paper. And he seems very reasonable, and so therefore, like they're to a certain type of woman, especially like there's something that's extremely appealing about him, right? He seems intelligent, he seems successful, he seems smart, he seems interesting, and he has previously not been interested in anyone, and now he's interested in me, and so therefore, I find that all very interesting. But then underneath all of that is this sort of like caddish, sort of like buffoonish nature that is, very subversive. It's like subverting that trope of the sort of like Mr. Darcy type, right? Basically, this is what we're talking about. And I think he plays that so well that it's like it's hard to not think of him like that for me as someone who's seen a bunch of his films like that. But yeah, if you just saw him as like grumpy old man Walter Matthau, you'd be like, he's the one that's at the center of all these like rom-coms, really?
And even in Grumpy Old Men, he's a part of the rom-com.
Yeah, well, that is true. That is fair enough. Now, a very different type of role for him is my next movie. It's a film called Failsafe. I don't know. Have you heard this
Oh,
movie,
of
the
course.
Sidney Lumet movie?
Where
So
they
this
did it
came out.
live. I think they did it live, didn't they? Or was it, or am I just thinking of the remake with George Clooney?
Oh.
They did it live.
Oh, I don't know if they did it live. I don't know anything about that. That could be true. But I know that the film, it came out in 1964. And it's basically this like horror story of what happens if, like, we're in the middle of the Cold War, right? And there has been some sort of mechanical failure that has led to a US bomber with a nuclear weapon approaching Moscow, unable to be stopped, basically. And the US government is trying desperately to get him to turn around, to shoot him down, to prevent him from launching a nuclear bomb onto Moscow, therefore, like, not only ending Moscow, but also kicking off what would be a like world-ending nuclear war between us and Russia. And that is and so the story here is like, how does President of the United States Henry Fonda convince Russia to not attack us back, to believe that this has all been a horrible accident. And there's all of this tension around trying to do everything they possibly can to, one, get that plane down before it launches the bomb, and two, if it's impossible to stop, to convince the Russians that this is all a horrible accident. And like, there's so much tension to this. We get the story is told mostly just in boardrooms and then, like, you know, strategy walls, like as if it's like a game of Risk where there's like light, like flashing lights of where the planes are. You know, it's like we're not getting big action set pieces. We're not getting anything like that. It's so locked in, so small scale in terms of the actual sets and the way that this has been presented to us. But the emotions of it and the real world consequences of it are so gigantic that it just builds and it builds and it builds, and it's this hugely intense and movie that is so well acted. And Walter Matthau is there as like a real son of a bitch who's like, hey, I'm this like expert on like nuclear war or on Russia or whatever, and I believe that we should use this to our advantage and like force them to like surrender their government. And like he's like an advocate for nuclear war. He has this very cynical idea that like the war is going to come no matter what, so we should be the ones to start it and we should be the ones to end it. And it's like a real heel turn for Walter Matthau. There's really nothing very redeeming about his character at all,
Nope.
which is really, really interesting because I feel like in other things that I've seen, even when he is, you know, caddish or maybe even kind of the bad guy, there's something like endearing underneath that that he brings, right? You know, the bad news bears of it all. There's no bad news bears vibes to this role. So I think it's a very, very fun, very convincing by Walter Matthau.
Right. So the George Clooney remade it in 2000, and that one they performed live on TV.
Okay. See,
Walter
I was
Cronkite,
busy
Richard Dreyfuss.
watching Hanging Up in theaters, so I didn't know that.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
But so that, yeah, so that's my number three. Did you want to talk about this movie at all?
No. Okay. Keep going.
Okay.
I don't talk about that. I'm when I get to my my list on the finale, then I go into it. But no, I enjoyed Failsafe, and I enjoyed the remake also. And now that we're talking about it makes me want to go rewatch both of them. So I know what I'm
Yeah.
going to be watching tomorrow.
Awesome. And it's great. It's like shot. It's all black and white film, cinematography, and it's really beautiful. And especially considering how minimal the actual filmmaking is, it's a really impressive film. My number two is a film by writer-director Elaine May of Nichols and May fame. It's a film called A New Leaf. I don't know if you've heard of this one,
Of course,
but
I've seen it.
it's a great film.
Alex,
It's
I told you,
again.
it's you're good. It's going to be difficult for you to find something I haven't seen. There are movies I
Okay.
haven't seen, but I'm saying it's going to be difficult.
Fair enough. Well, I'll have you come on the podcast and we'll talk about random. I do a Tom Holland podcast, and so you'll come on that and I'll tell you about some Tom Holland movies that you've definitely never heard of.
My favorite Tom Holland movie, out of like the MCU and stuff like that is well, what's the name of it with the tidal wave? Damn,
The Impossible.
The Impossible. Yes.
That,
I
you know,
love him
that
in
that
that
was
movie.
his first film,
Yeah, I know.
his screen debut, which is very
And
impressive
he
as
was
a young
amazing
actor.
in it.
He's fantastic. He is low key the star of that film. That if you
Oh,
listen to my
sure.
episode on that, I believe he is the protagonist and he totally steals that movie from Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. He's great as an 11-year-old. It's wild, but we're not talking about that right now. Instead, you're
No,
talking about A
we're
New
talking about the new
Leaf.
leaf.
Which is a very different kind of movie that also feels a little impossible because it's a sort of like madcap comedy where Walter Matthau basically plays this like kind of like not good dude who loses all of his money and decides that he is going to get his money back by marrying a eccentric heiress played by Aline May, basically tricking her into marrying him and then murdering her is what the plan is.
Why not?
And from that, a love story is born, and it is so crazy that that movie works. It is, there's no reason why it should work. It should, in every world, that movie should be a total disaster. And yet it is so charming and so winning and so wonderful. And it's a great showcase by him. And it's a great showcase for Elaine May, who is so funny and so charming. And it's the type of movie that makes you feel sad that she didn't make a dozen more films after that, instead of basically making Ishtar and that's it.
She had a lot of problems in Hollywood.
Yeah. But speaking of problems in Hollywood, my number one, and this is probably an unconventional number one, but it's the one I've actually seen most recently, and so it kind of it might be it might be a, you know, recency bias, but it's a film that I really enjoyed watching. It's called California Suite. It's from the 1970s. It's 1978 specifically. Now, Walter Matthau is just a small part of this the ensemble here. It's because if you haven't seen California Suite, it's basically a series of short stories of different couples basically who are on vacation in California, and what happens. And so, you know, there's lots of
Neil
different
Simon for you.
people.
That's the way Neil Simon did those things at the time.
And he wrote it, and it's directed by Herbert Ross. A great cast, like, you know, Jane Fonda, Maggie Smith, Alan Alda, Michael Caine, Elaine May again, Walter Matthau, they reunite, so that's
Richard
part of it.
Pryor.
Bill Cosby, playing a deeply unlikable person, which I'm sure when the movie came out, that was like, oh wow, what a, you know, surprise to see. But actually, like, feels very, it was a lot easier for me to watch him on screen in this role because, like, I think it might be kind of just how he actually was, as it turned out. But very, very fun. And the Walter Matthau piece of the movie is he is married to Elaine May. He is coming to Los Angeles from Philadelphia for his nephew's bar mitzvah. His brother, played by Stan from the Golden Girls, if you've ever watched Stan, Herb
Urbino.
Edelman. So he was wonderful, and that was a surprise. I did not know that he was in the movie before I sat down to watch it. He buys Walter Matthau a sex worker for the evening, because his what because Walter Matthau's wife is traveling the next day, because they're very conscientious parents. They don't want to fly in the same airplane just in case one of them goes down, and then their children are orphaned. So Walter Matthau came first, and then, you know, there is his brother gives him a gift that he did not ask for, and briefly tries to resist, and then ultimately, without that much pushback, decides to embrace. And unfortunately for him, Elaine May shows up when he has overslept and his sex worker is still asleep in bed, passed out after drinking a whole bottle of tequila. And so there's a huge comedy of errors where, you know, our guy tries to keep Elaine May from discovering the sex worker in his bed, and it's all very ridiculous. And I think it's a really fun showcase for Walter Matthau and just how, in that very unique way, that he is able to be a comedic presence in a film. So, and it was, you know, reteaming him with Elaine May, which was very fun, where she gets to be much more of the straight man, in this one, versus the alternative dynamic that she had with him in A New Leaf. So I think that the film overall is probably stronger in other aspects, like in other storylines, like the Jane Fonda Alda story and the Maggie Smith Michael Caine story. Those are my two favorites in the film. But it's a really fun showcase for Walter Matthau.
Alex, this is really bad. You're making me want to go rewatch movies.
I'm doing my job.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for that list. So today we every day we have a segment called Name That Remake, where I will describe a movie to you,
Okay.
and I'll tell you what year the original came out and what year the remake came out, and you have to try and guess what the movie is.
Am I allowed to ask for clues in
Sure, you
addition
can
to
ask
that,
whatever.
or
Sure,
hints?
no problem. All
Okay.
right, so I'm spinning the wheel. Let's see what movie we get to. Okay. Interesting. I need to figure out how to deal with this. Okay, this is a movie that originally came out in 1961 and was remade in 2021.
Okay.
And it's about two star-crossed lovers who
West Side
belong
Story.
to exactly who belong to different gangs. Yeah. It's actually funny when we talked earlier about the 12 Angry Men. In my mind, I was thinking, am I going to talk about 12 Angry Men or West Side Story? And I guess it's a good thing I didn't talk about West Side Story either.
Yeah, there you go. See, but that, you know what? That's an example of a very good remake where I think it
I
honestly
agree.
might be better than the original. Because, I mean, it's directed by Steven Spielberg, and his direction brings so much to it.
I agree with you. I love the new one, and I love some of the changes they made in the new one. So that's actually one of the ones that's very difficult for me to make the call as to which is better. Because it's so close. But then you also then ask the question, did it really need to be remade? That's the question that I would still ask. Again, I loved it. I really enjoyed watching it, but did you need it? Because the original was just so amazing, and they weren't able to bring us something that is 10 times better. Maybe even if it's slightly better, I don't know if it's really, because again, the Academy loved it in 61 and hated it in 2021 because it got one Oscar and that was it.
Yeah, that was a weird thing though, but it did get, it got
Take out Best
the
Supporting
return
Actress.
Oscar, right? Yeah, it got Best Supporting Actress the second time around. So I think that was a weird year for, I mean, 2021 was a very weird year for the Oscars because it was like we're still in the middle of COVID and like that movie came out in theaters, but it came out like it was targeting a demographic that didn't actually show up to the movies for another 6 months. So like I feel like it got tagged with not being successful at the box office when it was like that movie was never going to work at that time in the box office. So I like my like I if it had come out in 2023, I still think it probably could have, well, not 2023 because that was Oppenheimer year. If it come out in 2022, I think it
No,
could have
right. Well,
swept the Oscars.
I think it was supposed to. It was originally supposed to come out in 2020, and that year it would have
Yeah.
swept the Oscars because in 2020, that's when Nomadland won.
Sure. A
They
film I loved, but I know that's not everybody did.
were. I'm not a fan of Nomadland at all, but okay. But do you think Nomadland is better than West Side Story? If
I
you were to
do.
have to vote between the two of them, you would have voted for Nomadland.
I would have voted for Nomadland, but I would have expected West Side Story to win, if that makes sense. I'm used to my favorite film in the Oscars winning once every 6 or 7 years. So my expectation is not that my favorite film of the year will win the
I'm
best
the same way.
picture.
I'm the same way. Up until 98, I did think that the best movie would win, and then the year that Saving Private Ryan lost to Shakespeare in Love, you realize that okay, the game has changed, and they're not going to be necessarily choosing the best movie every year because it's now politics.
Yeah, well, there's a great book called Oscar Wars from that came out a couple years ago that's a great history of the Oscars. And if you read that, you'll see that it has always been politics and the campaigning that goes on and how the origins of the award show in and of itself was a political act. So very, very fun book. I would highly recommend people check that out. But
I'm
yeah, it's always been
definitely.
politics.
That I'm sure of. I mean, come on.
Every generation has its own like action, like activation moment when it comes to the Oscars, where it's like, oh no, like the scales fall from your eyes and you realize like that there's more than just is it a good movie or not. And that's part
Exactly.
of the fun of being a film fan,
Yes,
having
for
that
sure.
moment.
Yeah. I mean, that's why the greatest show on Earth won in 1952. When nobody expected it to, well, it shouldn't have won. Let's put it that way.
And that's also what makes when a really fantastic film that you love actually win, it though that makes it that much more satisfying because you know that it's like winning despite all of these odds against it and all these like complicated nonsense. So.
No, there's no question about that. I mean, that was That was just I'm as a huge movie fan and a huge Oscar fan, so I'm familiar with everything that's gone on over the last 90 plus years with the Oscars. So yeah, but High Noon was something that should have theoretically it's a much better movie than The Greatest Show on Earth, but it was politics. Literally, it was politics because it was the whole thing with HUAC and all that stuff that came out at the time. So.
Yep. Now, 1974 as an Oscar year. Are you disappointed that taking Pelham 1-2-3 didn't get in there?
No,
It's
I don't think.
pretty tough class to break into.
Yeah, I don't know. It wouldn't. Again, I like it better than all the movies that were nominated that year, but I don't think that it would. It doesn't fit into the Oscar mold for that year.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never seen Harry and Tonto. I don't know if Art Carney deserved it over Walter
Art Carney
Matthau.
was amazing in that movie. You
Okay, I'll take
should
your
see
word
it.
for
You
it.
should see it. It's again, it's a movie that up until I saw it, I was like, "What the hell is this movie?" And then I watched it, and it was like, "Wow."
Yeah,
It's
I would.
about a middle-aged man that is trying to restart his life. So yeah, it's very good. I'm not going to go too much into it, but again, I'm a big fan of it. So,
You stand by it. Okay. How about
oh
The Towering Inferno? Do you think that the taking of Pelham 1 and 2, 3 should have gotten a Best Picture nomination over The Towering Inferno?
no,
Huge
not at all.
sensation that year, but
Not at all.
I don't think we look on that.
Towering Inferno is such an amazing movie.
Okay.
Again, I don't think that I still think that The Taking of Pelham 1-3 is a better movie. But when you look at it, you have to look at it through Oscar eyes.
Yeah.
And Taking of Pelham 1-3 was not something that anyone saw on any level for the Oscars. I mean, come on, they didn't even give David Shire an Oscar nomination for his music. And I've seen so many lists that the music for this movie is considered one of the best movie scores ever. But then again, Shawshank didn't win anything either. You can always find a year where there's something that just doesn't make any sense.
Yep, always.
Exactly. All right, so Alex, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow all the work that I do for thepopbreak.com by going to thepopbreak.com. Click on the podcast tab. You'll see all the podcasts that I supervise over there, all the podcasts that I help shepherd. We have podcasts about movies, music, film. I said that already. Music,
Movies and film
movies.
are different. That's fine.
That's fair. Yeah. We also had comic books, anime, all that stuff. We cover it all. It's really fun. Some of the shows that I host over there, I do a monthly podcast on superhero movies. It's called Bill versus the MCU. My co-host Bill Bodkin and I, we started out rewatching every Marvel movie that was part of the MCU. We did that in 2022, and we've been keeping it going ever since by doing different seasons on Marvel TV and on Marvel films. Recently, we did our Marvel Zombies Era miniseries where we talked about all of the films that Marvel Entertainment put out before Marvel Studios began. So that's like the Fantastic Four movies, that's Blade, that's Daredevil and Elektra, Hulk, all of those films. So that was really fun. We did that as a lead up to the Fantastic Four, The Next Steps.
I'm sorry that you guys had to go through all those movies again.
It was an experience, that's for sure. But in the past, we've covered all the X-Men movies. We've covered a lot of we did all of the Defenders television shows from Netflix. We did the first 4 seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And this fall, we're going to be doing a whole season on Marvel animation series from the last few years.
Oh, wow.
So, like that's the 3 seasons of What If, the kind of the Hulu shows that they did, like MODOK and Hitmonkey, and also we're going to be talking about the Spider-Man, Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, and Eyes of Wakanda, and Marvel Zombies, which are coming out this fall. So all that is something to look forward to. But in addition to that, a podcast that I do twice a month with my friend Manish Mathur is called It's Complicated. a Tom Holland podcast, and we are running through Tom Holland's entire filmography twice a month. Every single thing that he's done, film, television, and stage, we're covering it leading up to his big month in July of 2026 when he is going to be starring in Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey and Spider-Man: Brand New Day. So, and in as we're getting excited for that, we're covering all of his stuff, anything that he has been in, whether it's a voice role, whether it's a TV show, anything that we've seen, even some viral videos along the way. So definitely join us for that. That's been a lot of fun.
Very cool. All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, chew.
Gesundheit.